Awesome. Thank you so much, worship team. Well, before I begin today, I just want to mention just a couple things. First of all, our Genesis series is coming to a close today slash next week-ish. We're going to have some some reflection next week. Next week is going to be a family service where we're going to have the kids in our service. It's going to be our dedication baptism membership service, and we're going to have the kids in the service, and they're going to have a segment of the service where they share with us some of the memory verses that they learned this coming year, and with some reflections in the series as a whole. But after that, we're going to have a brief topical series, on the topic of worry. And you'll see this in your bulletin. And what I'd love for you to do is just write out on the bottom of this insert, what worries you the most in life? And then what I'm going to do is I'm going to take these comments and see what the Bible says about your comments. I've already received a few, and I'm so thankful for that. If I don't get any more, well, I don't know what's going to happen. We'll just move on to the next series. But just encourage you to fill this out and put it in the worry box in the by the welcome display, or put it in the offering bag, or hand it to me or Brenda or whatever. We'd love to hear your comments. Anyways, we're continuing on today with the story of Joseph and Jacob and his sons. And last week we looked at God's predictions of the future and Egypt and Israel's growth and Jacob's blessing over his grandchildren. And we concluded a few things last week. We concluded that God is in control. God is in control of time. He's in control of the nations, and he's in control of people. And this week we're going to look at Jacob's blessing over his children and his and Joseph's death, which will lead us to the end of Genesis. So let me pray before we begin today. God, as we look again at the end of Genesis and look at the end of one's life, Lord, help us to remember what matters to you in the end. Lord, please remove any distractions or anything that may be hardening our hearts to what you want to say to us today. And we just pray all these things in your name, Jesus. Amen. So today what I'd like to do with you is share some points with you as we highlight certain passages in these final two chapters. And let me just remind you what the previous scene was. The previous scene is where Jacob, he goes ahead and he blesses his two grandchildren, in other words, Joseph's sons, and he blesses the younger before the older. So there's a lot of reversals that are taking place in last week's scene. Now, the scene for today, Jacob, he's lived a long life. And he knows for whatever reason he's about to die. And I don't know if it's because of illness or old age or a combination of the two. But whatever the case, he's at his deathbed. And he gathers his children around his deathbed as he's about to speak blessings over them. Now, I'm sure this is a very emotional time for the entire family. And if you've ever had a loved one pass away, later on in life, you can probably relate. I haven't had parents pass away, but I have had grandparents and friends pass away, and of course, it can be a very difficult time. Some say watching a parent pass away is actually a very, very beautiful experience, while others might describe it as gut-wrenching, and still others might say, well, it's both beautiful and gut-wrenching at the same time. And so, you know, as they're in this emotional state, would they be paying attention to what's going on around them? Would they be hanging on Jacob's every word? Would there be some moments of jealousy or comparison or regret or thankfulness? Was there any unfinished business they needed to tie up before their father died? I wonder what was going on through their minds at this time. The theme I'm working with today is in the end. What's most important in the end? And with the death of these important characters, Jacob, and later on in Joseph, and with the final blessings of the sons of Israel, this passage forces us to consider what matters most in life. However, as we consider what's most important in the end, we have a gift. We have time on our side as we consider these points to make the appropriate changes in our life. And so here's the points under this theme of in the end. Number one, in the end, respect for parents and sexual purity matters. It's kind of a two-for-one point, and you'll see why as we get to the text. In the end, respect for parents and sexual purity matters. Number two, in the end, innocent lives matter. Number three, in the end, Jesus will rule. Number four, in the end, we need to forgive. And number five, in the end, God is faithful and we need to trust him. Let's start with point number one, in the end, respect for parents and sexual purity matters. And we're going to focus on Reuben, Jacob's blessing over Reuben. I say blessing because it actually turned into a curse. And you're going to see why in Genesis chapter 49. I'm going to start with verse 1 and read the verse 4. Then Jacob called for his sons and said, "Gather around so I can tell you what will happen to you in days to come. Assemble and listen, sons of Jacob. Listen to your father Israel. Reuben, you are my firstborn, my might, the first sign of my strength, excelling in honor, excelling in power. Turbulent as the waters, you will no longer excel, for you went up unto your father's bed, unto my couch, and defiled it." Some of you might be scratching your heads and wondering what was the issue that Jacob had with Reuben? Did he spill something on his father's bed? You know, I don't know. No, the background story is summarized in one sentence back in Genesis 35:22, and this is what happened. One sentence changed Reuben's future. While Israel was living in that region, Reuben went in and slept with his father's concubine Bilhah, and Israel heard of it. So Reuben sleeps with his father's concubine. So on top of all the dysfunction we've heard so far in the family, can you imagine living in a family where the son has had sex with his father's wife or concubine? This is totally messed up. And so you can imagine there's a few issues with this. First of all, Reuben has deeply disrespected his father by doing such a thing. This was a huge no-no, and it still is a huge no-no in our culture to do such a thing. And it's no surprise that parental disrespect in our world is still present as well. In fact, Paul gives a list of things we're going to see in people during the last days, and one of those things is that people are going to be disobedient to their parents. I learned this firsthand as a youth pastor. We had this policy that if we took some youth on a social or an event and they couldn't pay, we would just go ahead and pay their way, and we wouldn't ask too many questions, just not to make people feel uncomfortable. And so we had this occasion once where I was taking the youth on a trip out of the city, a few hours down the road. It was an overnight event, and this community girl comes with a signed parental permission form slip on a Friday afternoon. And I'm thinking, okay, she has no money with her. That's fine. We'll pay her way. And so she comes with us to Acquire the Fire, this youth conference. And Friday night was amazing. We all went to this conference, and we went back to the hotel Friday night. And then all of a sudden, around midnight or so, I get a call from the police. And the policeman is talking to me on the phone and says, "Hey, Ryan, do you have such and such a person with you at this youth event?" And I said, "Yes. Why are you calling? Why do you ask?" And they said, "Well, this person has been filed as a missing person." It turns out that she had plagiarized her parents' signature, and she did not tell her parents that she was coming to this youth event with me. And now she was then filed as a missing person. The police figured it out, of course. Anyways, so a few hours later, at 3 or 4 in the morning, the parents come. They're obviously upset about the whole situation. The parents come, and I'm standing outside of this girl's hotel room, and as soon as the parents come, she comes out with her nose in the air, shoulders back, just walking down the hallways as if nothing happened. No apologies, no regret, and the parents were just kind of slowly walking behind their daughter. I tried to follow up later to see how it could help, but I'm sure the parents were just too embarrassed to talk about the situation. Parental disrespect in our world is present, and it's not a good thing. Now, rest assured, you should know I've talked to Pastor Josh about that story so he can learn from my mistakes. Anyways, respect for parents is so important to God that he made it one of the Ten Commandments to honor your parents. And the Lord promises his blessing if we do so. Now, some of you here are probably wishing, you know, Pastor Ryan makes a really good point. I wish my teen or my young adult child was present to hear this point. But remember, I think this is a commandment that applies as long as your parents are living. So before you give your children a hard time, consider how you are treating your parents who are perhaps later on in age. The second thing that Reuben does in this act of disrespect, he also commits a sexual sin by sleeping with his father's concubine. Now, in that culture, because it was one of the highest blessings to have many children, a wife might offer her maid to her husband if they weren't having children or if they wanted to have more children. And we see that with many of the patriarchs. Now, right or wrong, it was just the reality of that culture to have wives, multiple wives and concubines. But it makes you wonder, because of the multiple wives and the multiple concubines, how many layers of dysfunction would there have been in the family? Was Bilhah neglected by Jacob? How close in age was she to Reuben? I mean, Reuben would have been the firstborn. Bilhah maybe would have been a bit younger. Maybe they connected a bit more. I don't know. Was this an act of defiance on Reuben's part? Was there something more than just a sexual sin? Did it represent some odd power struggle within the family? Whatever the case, Reuben's act was wrong. And you need to know that sex scandals can really mess up your life on so many levels. You know, I've reflected quite a bit in life, and there's about six categories of lessons that I want to pass on to my kids. And one of them is remaining, living within God's sexual standards and having proper respect for others. And Reuben misses the boat on two of these things. Consider these stats as we talk about living within God's sexual standards. For those living in a cohabiting relationship compared to those who are married, women are 4 times more likely to cheat. Men are 8 times more likely to cheat. Children are 20 times more likely to be abused. And if the father is not the biological father, children are 32 times more likely to be abused. Now, you may have come from a situation, maybe you are in a situation where you're living common law, and these are just stats, remember that. But God has a lot to say about sex. And we'd better listen, because there are blessings and benefits for those who do. What I was going to say is that, you know, these are just stats, and they might not be true for you, but there's definite benefits and blessings for following God's standards. Anyways, in the end, because of Reuben's disrespect to his father and his sexual sin, he misses out on the blessings of the firstborn, and instead, he doesn't even receive a blessing, he receives a curse. So the firstborn is passed over with the firstborn blessing. And so in the end, respect for parents and sexual purity matters. Are we honoring our parents and living within God's sexual standards as we look at the life of Reuben? The second point is this. In the end, innocent lives matter. And to this, we focus in on the words that Jacob speaks over Simeon and Levi, the next oldest. Surely, Reuben was passed over, but surely there's going to be a blessing for Simeon and Levi. Genesis 49:5-7. Simeon and Levi are brothers. Their swords are weapons of violence. Let me not enter their council. Let me not join their assembly, for they have killed men in their anger and hamstrung oxen as they pleased. Cursed be their anger, so fierce, and their fury so cruel. I will scatter them in Jacob and disperse them in Israel. And so it looks like this patriarch Jacob, after looking at the first 3 sons, we are 0-3. The next 2 sons receive a curse. And their story can be found back in Genesis 34. And it goes, I'm not going to read it to you, but I'm going to summarize it. Jacob had many sons, but he also had a daughter named Dinah. And as Dinah was visiting the people of the area one day, a man by the name of Shechem, who was a ruler, went and appears to have raped Dinah. And so the story goes on to explain how he loved her, how he really wanted to marry her, to the point where the father discussed the possibility of them getting married. But when the brothers heard about this incident, they were furious, as you can imagine. Any brother would be furious if he heard that his sister was raped. At the same time, Shechem was doing his best to desperately work out a deal with Jacob and the brothers so he could marry Dinah. He was willing to pretty much do absolutely anything to have her. And so the brothers said they would agree on one condition, that Shechem and all the males in his city would be circumcised. To which they talked about and agreed, and they all got circumcised on a particular day. And then a few days later, the text says, while the men were still in pain, Simeon and Levi, which were Dinah's brothers, took their swords and attacked the unsuspecting city, killing every male, followed by the rest of the brothers plundering the city and taking everything they had. And that particular story closes with Jacob expressing deep frustration and deep disappointment with their actions. Anyways, because of their violence towards people in this story and their reputation for killing animals for fun, the blessing is passed over them as well, and they receive a curse. And so, in the end, you need to know that innocent lives do matter to God. Consider this quote by a man by the name of Nicholas Kristof. He says this. He says, more girls were killed. He's speaking of abortion, by the way. More girls were killed in the last 50 years precisely because they were girls than men killed in all the wars in the 20th century. More girls are killed in this routine gendercide in any one decade than people were slaughtered in all the genocides of the 20th century. Or it's said that approximately 6 million Jews were killed in the Holocaust. Consider this. Here's a question I want to ask you. I want someone to shout out just a guess. How many innocent babies do you think were killed worldwide in the past 50 to 60 years? Any guesses out there? Shout it out. 50 million. 50 million. 100 million. One more guess. 150 million. It's estimated that 1 billion babies have been killed because of abortion. And by the way, I got that estimate as I spoke to someone from Advocate Life and Education Services this past week. I just called them up and asked them, hey, can you give me some numbers, some stats here? And remember, our country, Canada, has contributed to that number. And I should just call it a number. It's a wrong. It's a grave injustice. And so to put it lightly, I don't think God is impressed. In fact, it's one of the Ten Commandments that we shall not kill. Perhaps to put things in a more positive light as we consider the poor and vulnerable around us, consider James 1:27. Religion that God our Father accepts as pure and faultless is this, to look after orphans and widows in their distress and to keep oneself from being polluted by the world. In the end, innocent lives matter to God, and it should matter to us as well. And also, of course, going along with this whole concept of God caring for innocent lives, he cares for the poor and vulnerable among us as well. Let's move on to the third point, which is this. In the end, Jesus will rule. And with this, we turn our attention to the blessing over Judah. Now we're on the fourth born child. So far, we're 0 for 3. Are we going to go 0 for 4, or are we going to get a hit here? 1 for 4. And so Genesis 49, verse 8 and following says, Judah, your brothers will praise you. We're off to a good start. Judah, your brothers will praise you. Your hand will be on the neck of your enemies. Your father's sons will bow down to you. In other words, Judah is now receiving the blessing of the firstborn. You are a lion's cub, Judah. You return from prey, my son. Like a lion, he crouches and lies down. Like a lioness, who dares to rouse him? Pay attention to verse 10. We'll come back to this. The scepter will not depart from Judah, nor the ruler's staff from between his feet, until he to whom it belongs shall come, and the obedience of the nations shall be his. He will tether his donkey to a vine, his colt to the choicest branch. He will wash his garments in wine, his robes in the blood of grapes. His eyes will be darker than wine, his teeth whiter than milk. And so Judah, the fourth-born child, gets the firstborn blessing. Excuse me. More importantly, verse 10 speaks of a ruler that's going to come through his line that will rule the nations. And I believe that Jacob is talking about Jesus here. Jesus will rule and judge the nations. And this is exciting news. Just to name one passage that references this truth, in Matthew 25, verse 31 to 33, says, When the Son of Man, speaking of Jesus, comes in his glory and all his angels are with him, he will sit on his glorious throne. The people of every nation will be gathered in front of him. He will separate them as a shepherd separates the sheep from the goats. He will put the sheep on his right, but the goats on his left. And so Jesus will one day rule and reign, and we must give an account. And as this whole concept makes me think of the end of life, it makes me think about Judgment Day and standing before God on Judgment Day. And it makes me wonder, who will do better on Judgment Day as we consider that we have to give an account to Jesus? Consider this. And maybe you can answer in your own minds here. Who do you think will fare better on Judgment Day? The Nazis who killed millions of Jews in the Holocaust, or Canada who has killed millions of innocent babies? Or what about the high-profile, successful Christian leader who couldn't keep his family together, or the man who struggled throughout life in dead-end jobs but created an environment where his children grew up and loved the Lord? Who do you think will fare better? Or what about the young woman who decided to keep her baby despite struggling and being judged throughout life compared to the woman who ended her child's life in the name of convenience and went on to have a picture-perfect family and become an outstanding citizen? Who will fare better? Or what about the married couple who stayed faithful to each other till death, and the young man who stayed celibate in the midst of enormous social pressure to do otherwise, compared to those who simply just follow their heart and do whatever pleases them and move on from relationship to relationship? Who will do better? Or what about the rich man who gave away millions of dollars to charity, but still lived in a life of luxury compared to the elderly woman who gave $100 to starving children and having to cut her hydro bill as a result? How is God going to judge all that? In the end, Jesus will rule and we must give an account. And so it begs the question, are you ready to stand before him? If not, remember, we have this great gift. You have time to do business with God and ask him to help you. Let's move on. The text then goes over the final chapters of Genesis. They go over and it covers the rest of Jacob's blessings over his children. You can read that later on your own time. It closes with Jacob giving his children some burial instructions, and then he draws his feet back up into bed, and then he breathes his last. He dies. And the story records again that this was an incredibly emotional time in the life of the family. At this moment, Joseph just throws himself over his father, and he weeps. The Egyptians take 40 days to embalm him. And I didn't read this, I didn't notice this on my first read of this passage, but they took a full 70 days of mourning. 70 days. On top of that, when they went to transport the body to the burial site, they bring all the high officials from Egypt, and they appear to hang out at the burial site for 7 extra days. I mean, people will typically hang out at a burial site for maybe a half hour, an hour or something, you know, but they are at the burial site, it appears, for an additional 7 days. And so it was an intense time of mourning for the brothers and the family in Israel and all of Egypt. Anyways, they bury their father, they return back to Egypt, but then something very interesting happens. Now that daddy's dead, the brothers were worried that Joseph is going to maybe seek revenge and treat them badly, maybe even kill them. And so they acknowledge the situation before Joseph. They go to Joseph and they go ask him for forgiveness. And it's very, very interesting how Joseph responds to their request for forgiveness, which leads us to our fourth point. In the end, we need to forgive. Genesis 50, verse 17 to 21 says, "When their message came to him, Joseph wept." Joseph cried quite a bit in this story. It's interesting how, I don't have this in my notes, but it's interesting how the narrator just is constantly saying, Joseph is just constantly weeping at every turn. Anyways, when the message came to him, Joseph wept. His brothers came and threw themselves down before him. "We are your slaves," they said, but Joseph said to him, "Don't be afraid. Am I in the place of God?" And then he says this, "You intended to harm me, but God intended it for good, to accomplish what is now being done, the saving of many lives. So then, don't be afraid. I will provide for you and your children." And he reassured them and spoke kindly to them. You know, we kind of talked about this, not kind of, we did talk about this point last week, maybe the week before, and maybe I'm getting my weeks mixed up. But the Bible is constantly telling us over and over and over and over and over and over and over again that we need to forgive. So it's worth saying again, even though we recently talked about this. I read an article on MSN.com. It was entitled 25 Habits to Help You Feel Happier and Healthier. And one of those habits is to not hold a grudge. I want to read to you what they wrote here. It says, "It's one thing to get upset over an injustice you suffered at the hands of someone else, but it's another thing entirely to hold on to that emotion long term. That's called holding a grudge, and it can easily consume you if you're not careful." Excuse me. "The reason this is so bad for your happiness is because the negative emotions associated with grudges eventually give way to resentment and thoughts of revenge. In turn, this leaves little room for your emotional repertoire for anything else. Like happiness, according to the Mayo Clinic, what's more, decades of research have linked this simple act to better overall heart health, less psychological stress, improved physical ability, and longer life. That's why it's always better to forgive and move on than to hold a grudge. And so I'm sure right now, there's very likely, odds are, someone here is sitting here and they're struggling with this issue. And you're holding on to a grudge, your heart is growing bitter, and it's killing you. And I want to suggest to you today, if that's you, that holding a grudge and remaining bitter isn't just unfortunate. It's a sin. It's wrong. And if you're in this situation for the sake of, well, not just your own sake, but for everyone else around you, please forgive. Because in the end, we need to forgive. And Joseph's example is just a beautiful example of forgiveness. And the final point we have for today is that in the end, God is faithful and we need to trust him. God is faithful, we need to trust him. And as I reflect on this point, I found something very fascinating about what I found here. The text fast forwards to the end of Joseph's life, and Joseph says this before he dies in Genesis 50 to verse 24 and 25. Then Joseph said to his brothers, I'm about to die, but God will surely come to your aid and take you up out of this land to the land he promised on oath to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. And Joseph made the Israelites swear an oath and said, God will surely come to your aid, and then you must carry my bones from this place. And at first glance, my eyes just kind of glazed over this because, okay, Joseph is just giving some burial instructions. Okay, that's nice. Let's move on. But I think at a second glance, I think there's something way more significant going on here in this text. Joseph is saying this. He's saying, listen, God made us a promise. And God is going to fulfill his promise. He's going to fulfill his promise to us. And I'm so confident that God will fulfill his promise that I want you to promise to take my bones with you, not if, but when the Lord brings our people out to our own land. So in saying what Joseph said, this was a great monumental sign of faith on Joseph's part. God is going to take us here to there, and you got to take my bones with you. He was putting his faith in God's promise. And in a similar way, we need to be people of faith. Do you live your life in such a way that you believe that God will fulfill his promises? I've heard of an interesting quote that says, your dream should be as big as the God you serve. In the end, God is faithful and we need to trust him. So we've talked about some of the things that are most important in life, but the beauty, again, of those listening to this message today is that we still have time to work on these things. I should say, though, we don't know how much time we have. The Lord can come at any minute, any moment, any day, and if he doesn't come, well, the Lord could take us. And I also want to encourage you and say, you know, I'm sure most of us, maybe all of us, probably all of us, have probably messed up in some way in one of these categories. And I want to say that whatever your situation is as well, that God can redeem your situation. He can turn what the enemy meant for evil or your mistakes, and he can turn it into good and make some beautiful, fruitful, wonderful stories out of those ugly situations. And so I want to encourage you to turn your heart to him as well as you consider your life. But let me summarize the points again. Number one, in the end, respect for parents and sexual purity matters. In the end, innocent lives matter. In the end, Jesus will rule, and we need to give an account to him. In the end, we need to forgive. And lastly, in the end, God is faithful, and we need to trust in him. We're going to move into a time of communion now, and in many ways, the communion table reinforces some of the points we heard today in this message. And so if you are helping with communion today, I'm going to encourage you to come forward right now. And anyways, the communion table reminds us of Christ's rule as he conquered sin and death on the cross and rose again. It reminds us, the communion table reminds us that we are going to have to give an account to God one day. But it's not just a one-day thing. We have to give an account to God even now. And the Bible calls us to examine ourselves as we consider the communion table. The other thing that the communion table reminds us is that since Christ has forgiven us, we should be quick to forgive others and not let bitterness grow in our hearts toward others. So the communion table reminds us of that as well. That, hey, if the God of forgiveness lives in our heart, and if he has forgiven us of so much, then we should be quick to pass on that forgiveness to someone else. And so let the communion table remind you of that today. And lastly, the communion table also reminds us of, the communion table reminds us of God's promises to us, that we will one day celebrate with Jesus in eternity, and that we should live our lives looking forward to that day with excitement. And interestingly, that's the kind of the way that Joseph ended his life. He lived his life at the end of his day, excited that God was going to fulfill his promise, and he was going to take his people from slavery into the new promised land. And so let the communion table remind you that there are exciting days ahead for us, that God is going to fulfill his promises, that we will one day celebrate eternity with Jesus. And so before we partake, the Bible does tell us to take a moment to examine our hearts before we participate in communion. So let's take a moment and do that. God, we thank you for sending your one and only perfect Son, Jesus, to take our place on the cross. It should have been us on that cross, but we thank you and praise you that you were willing to make that sacrifice. Lord, we thank you for setting us free from our sin that separated us from you. And we thank you and we praise you, Lord, for your love, for your mercy, for your forgiveness, and for your grace in our lives.